You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. In the hours before Washington's legislative session ended last month, House Democrats called a vote. It was for a fix to what's called the Blake decision, a 2021 state Supreme Court ruling striking down Washington's felony drug possession law. In response, legislators put in place a temporary fix that treated knowingly carrying drugs as a misdemeanor. That measure is set to expire July 1st. But as the clock ticked down on the regular session, the votes weren't there. The state House failed to pass the bill, which threw the future of the state's drug possession law into question and prompted a number of cities and counties to scramble to pass their own patchwork of regulations. Today, the legislation is back for a special session. The legislature is back for a special session to try again. And lawmakers already have a deal. Washington State Standard reporter Jerry Kornfield is at the Capitol, and he joins me now. Hi, Jerry. What do we know about the compromise bill?
Well, without going into too deep into the weeds, those who have followed this issue are going to say it sure sounds like what the Senate passed in March. And it is. There's a gross misdemeanor for possession. But what they did is they whittled it into two crimes. There's a possession in public place and then use in public place. So you have two crimes. Gross misdemeanors, you can't be charged with both. So that's the penalty side. There's millions of dollars for treatment. So that's on the other side. And then you have some tinkering with the preemption clauses. So cities and counties, they will be able to keep doing some of the things they're doing with as it relates to like needle exchanges for their public health programs. They won't be able to stop an opioid treatment program directly, but they can have hearings if they want. The State Department of Health will not have to hold a hearing on a new program in a community, but they do need to communicate that they're coming. So that was a big issue. And prosecutors. Republicans pointed out that prosecutors were concerned they were losing control over who could go into the diversion program, sort of before their trial or after they've been convicted. They was going into the courts too much, and they regained their control over the diversion process. And what you have is a marriage of the progressive and conservative complaints that were there on the last day of session.
On the diversion point, the previous version of the bill said that on the first two offenses, somebody would have to be offered the option of diversion before going into the regular judicial process. Has that changed now?
It changed in this. They are encouraged. Police and prosecutors, I think the language of the bill still says encourage to direct someone into services, but they're not required.
Got it.
So that's one of the changes. And that was in the Senate original version that was the encouraging. So they had took away the requirement. I know that the big picture is hard for folks sometimes to step back and everyone's got their political viewpoints down here. But the big picture is the person who they encounter using an illicit drug on a street, they'll now be able to pick them up and offer them various pathways. You want to go to jail? That's a path. You want to go to treatment? That's a path. If you complete treatment, there's a path there. If you go to jail, you get convicted, go to jail, do your time, and then go to treatment, you can get your conviction vacated. So there's a whole bunch of pathways for these individuals. The goal is treatment and recovery and not making it become a permanent mark, that arrest, on their lives.
Mm. Jerry, last month, 15 Democrats defected and refused to back a gross misdemeanor penalty. Republicans had a variety of concerns, and no Republican voted for the version of the bill in the regular session. Now, typically, I would say if there's a vote being called, then legislative leadership knows they have the votes to pass it. But that didn't happen last time around. What's the prospect of passage here as the vote is imminent?
My experience was surprised last time, too, that they didn't have the vote. It's so rare that you bring it up for a vote if you can't pass it. This time will be different. It seems pretty clear leaders in the House, Republicans and Senate Republicans and the House Democrats and Senate Democrats all say we've counted. We've got more than 50% in both, and it'll be bipartisan. Now, I think what will surprise folks it's a possibility there will be fewer Democrats voting for it in the House than on that last night. They had 43 supported it before. I'm hearing that it might drop, but you will have Republicans voting for it. and more than enough to get over the 50%.
Are you hearing why those Democrats will drop off that voted for the last version?
I haven't heard any specifics. I mean, there were a lot of folks who don't want a penalty, of at least not a penalty of gross misdemeanor. If folks following this, again, know the House did pass one of their own versions with 54 votes, and it made it a misdemeanor. So I think some Democrats who voted for a lesser penalty before, now that they know Republicans are going to help pass the bill, I think they'll step back and say, you know what, I really don't want to give a heavier penalty. I can vote no. This can become law. My communities can say thank you. And, you know, everybody, sort of a win-win, and they can keep their political belief system intact.
Yeah. Isn't that the dance sometimes, that once you know a law is going to pass, some folks are able to change their votes to make a point? Jerry, how soon would this potentially pass both houses of the legislature? What is the next step here?
Well, I've been asking several folks today in the morning, what's your prediction? And there's a lot of confidence that by mid-afternoon today, they will be done with the bill in both chambers. Theoretically, if the Speaker of the House, the Lieutenant Governor in the Senate sign the bill, it could go to Governor Jay Inslee, and he could sign it today. He's ready. So, you know, folks, it may be done by mid-afternoon. And this issue may be put on. And I do want to think about the cities who have adopted some of these ordinances. They won't have to get rid of their local ordinance. They just won't be enforcing it per se. It'll just be on the books in case something comes up.
Jerry Kornfield is a reporter with the Washington State Standard, a brand new outlet already on our airwaves here and sharing great reporting. Jerry, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And news is moving quickly today. Since I spoke with Jerry minutes ago, the state Senate passed the compromise drug possession bill 43-6. Now it heads to the House and after that, possibly the governor's desk. As Jerry reported, under this compromise bill, there are some changes to pretrial diversion programs for drug possession and illegal drug use. In the new bill, prosecutors must consent to a defendant's participation in such programs. And instead of being required, prosecutors are now strongly encouraged to agree to diversion in gross misdemeanor cases involving cannabis or illegal prescriptions. Diversion programs, including drug courts, are also known as therapeutic courts, and they're meant to keep accused people out of the traditional court system. Their availability varies widely depending on the type of crime you're charged with and where you're facing charges. I recently talked about this with Christina Mason, president of the Washington State Association of Drug Court Professionals and Washington Association of Drug Courts. We recorded the interview Monday afternoon, minutes before the compromise bill was announced, and she explained to me how county drug diversion courts actually work.
So across Washington, there are about 27 Superior Court level adult drug courts right now. And individuals who are arrested on felony property crimes that are driven by their substance use disorder, crimes like vehicle theft or burglary, as well as some drug charges, they would be eligible for these adult drug courts, and they're offered a choice. They can always take their case to the mainstream legal system if they don't want to do drug court. But if they decide to participate in drug court, the court will provide treatment and often other resources to really help them engage in treatment and reduce barriers such as housing, transportation, certainly case management and peer support to help meet basic needs. And they will have requirements, things that they have to complete for drug court. They'll have to appear before the judge on a regular basis at hearings where their progress in treatment is reviewed. They will have to take random urinalysis, drug tests, and they'll have different milestones that they have to meet for that program. Drug courts kind of vary in length, but typically about a year would be the minimum amount of time that someone might complete a drug court in. And then in Washington state, most of our drug courts are pre-adjudication programs, which means that the person doesn't plead guilty, they don't accept a conviction while they're in the court program. The criminal charges that brought them into it are pending. And if they're able to successfully complete the program, then the felony charges are dismissed.
And what's the accountability mechanism to decide whether somebody graduates? Who's watching that? And how does somebody hit all the milestones they need to hit?
There are case managers, typically not probation officers, unless it is a post-adjudication drug court, but case managers that are getting reports from the person's treatment agency and checking in with the participant. And then the case managers are reporting to the judge before the participant's hearing. And people come in for hearings, you know, at the beginning, maybe every couple of weeks, later in the program, less often, maybe once a month. So once they've opted into a drug court, there is an evidence-based practice of applying sanctions and incentives. And so when the reports show that the person is in full compliance with all of their requirements, they will typically be given a reward by the court, certainly praise from the court. And that is an evidence-based practice called contingency management that helps people to be able to stop using substances and to really make some major changes in their lives to get that positive reinforcement. On the other hand, if there are requirements that they are not in compliance with, they would have what we call a sanction, which is just a consequence, a response from the court. There's a range of sanctions depending on how the person is out of compliance and kind of what point they are in the program, but they may have to do anything from a homework assignment or observing court for the day and kind of writing about it to, for a very high magnitude sanction, potentially spending a little while in jail.
What about other services? When you say that there's somebody who helps the defendant reach milestones, does that include help them find stable housing? I think one of the big obstacles that you see a lot in, for example, cycles of homelessness is drug addiction gets involved, housing gets unstable, and then it's really difficult to, say, be accountable to a court system.
Absolutely. I think that in Washington State, we've done a good job of recognizing that people need more than just treatment, that it's really critical to be able to provide case management, but also all kinds of tangible resources that support someone's recovery, including transitional housing, to be able to remove every possible barrier for somebody to help them engage in treatment and succeed in their recovery. And so that is an important part of drug courts, is providing that case management and the support to connect with those resources, including sometimes placing people into transitional housing, or if courts don't have as many resources, certainly making referrals to housing in the community.
And what happens if they don't graduate? What happens if things don't work out, they fall off the wagon, and they're not able to meet those milestones?
If they don't graduate, and, you know, it's, drug courts are not a zero tolerance program. We know that recovery is a process and that it's important if someone is not able to be successful, it's important to look at what resources you could provide to help support them, what other interventions you could put into place. So there's certainly a process to get to a point where you're not able to be successful in the program. And often that involves just not engaging at all, you know, not showing up for court, not showing up for treatment. But eventually, if someone is not able to be successful, they would be terminated from the program. And because the person will have waived their right to a jury trial and to take their case to the mainstream legal system at that point, because they've chosen to be in the drug court program, there would just be a bench trial where the judge reads the police report and then sentences the person on that. And of course, takes into account, you know, their effort and progress within the program in determining that sentence.
What does the data show about how many people graduate from these types of programs and their effectiveness in terms of recidivism?
One of the things that we know, at least in Washington, is that the program has a really significant effect in reducing recidivism, even for people that don't graduate the program. So the Department of Social and Health Services, they have data on our Washington State drug courts and produce an annual report. And the most recent data shows that at 36-month follow-up after a participant has started a drug court program, 75% of the drug court participants have no new felonies at 36-month follow-up. And that's really significant because most of them do have prior felonies coming in to our drug court programs, 80% of them have prior felonies, and they actually have an average of 4 prior felonies. So it'd be very reasonable to expect that that cycle would continue. And it's really clear that the drug court intervention has interrupted that cycle. 75% having no new felonies at 36-month follow-up, that's not just program graduates. That's every person who participates in a Washington State drug court for even one day, whether or not they decide to opt into the program.
So here we are talking about people with felony charges that they're facing opting into a pre-adjudication process that will put them on the path, hopefully, to graduate, be able to get those charges dismissed. And that's at the county superior court level. Now I want to pivot. Simple drug possession won't put you in superior court currently. You stay in the municipal or district level for misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor adjudication. What do diversion options currently look like for people who are facing misdemeanors across Washington State?
There are district and municipal courts in Washington State that already have therapeutic court programs, which are modeled on the adult drug court model, such as mental health courts, veterans courts, community courts, DUI courts. There are a few district or municipal court drug courts. There are 3, I believe, currently in Washington State. But I think it's understood that with possession likely becoming a misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor, either because the state legislates that or because individual cities decide to do that, it'll be critical to have these therapeutic alternatives, drug court programs, and other therapeutic courts at the lower court level, at the district and municipal court. And the legislature this session did anticipate and plan for that by appropriating $21 million for those district and municipal courts to put therapeutic alternatives into place or to make existing therapeutic alternatives more robust.
Is there anything else that you think listeners should know as legislators are looking at replacing Washington's drug possession law ahead of July 1st? Anything else folks should take away about this issue or about the availability or support out there for folks looking at diversion programs when it comes to drug charges?
I think it's important to understand that drug courts are an evidence-based program. They have been classified as evidence-based by the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, WISIP. And there are about 3 decades of research about best practices for drug courts and that can be applied to other therapeutic courts as well, how to run an effective drug court. And it is remarkable to be able to see the changes that people can make in a relatively short period of time. Often participants will come into the program experiencing homelessness, unemployed. They may have children whose lives they're not involved with. And often in just a year's time, the same individual will be unrecognizable as the person that you might have met early in the program. They will have housing. They will have full-time employment. They will be back in their children's lives. And so there's really, you know, a ripple effect. When somebody participates in a drug court, it gets them off the pathway to prison and helps them avoid incarceration and make changes in their life. But it also changes the lives of their children, really has a positive impact on the community in terms of reducing crime and recidivism. So it's such an important intervention. And I also think that it's important to have court alternatives and a full continuum of services in the community. So one of the things that this Senate Bill 5536, which is known as the Blake Bill, would also do is implement some of the recommendations of the Substance Use Recovery Services Advisory Committee, SURSAC, things like trying to put health engagement hubs and other harm reduction preventative services in the community to be able to divert people even before they might reach a court program. And so I think that that's critical to just have opportunities every step of the way for people to engage in services and be able to get support around stopping using and making life changes.
Christina Mason, president of the Washington State Association of Drug Court Professionals and Washington Association of Drug Courts. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I said this process was moving quickly in the special session. The House is now in session in Olympia looking at that compromised drug possession bill. We'll be following it all day on KUOW. Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.